Well, let's jump into our Sunday school then. We are talking about the rise of Islam in the church. Sadly, unfortunately, I forgot my notes, my old notes. So some of this I'm going to have to kind of use the memory a little bit. You got to, and it's too bad Nick's not here because he's got a map on the back, and I know how he likes maps. But maybe you can catch the second half of it. So Islam arose, as I think we probably all know, in Arabia. Muhammad was a man who lived 570 to 632 AD. He was originally a caravan driver, ended up marrying an older woman, who owned the caravans that he drove. He was a deeply mystical, very intense personality. He would frequently go into the mountains and have times of intense religious meditation and so forth. Arabia at the time, late 600s, early 700s, or late 6th century, early 7th century, I should say, was a time of, there was a lot of religious pluralism in Arabia at the time. There were the pagans that had been there kind of forever, the folk religions that had been there for a long time. There was a lot of Jews were in the area. There was a lot of Christians in the area. And in particular, there were a lot of Christians of the Aryan persuasion, a lot of Christians. It was kind of the case that a lot of times, because Arabia was on the outskirts of the empire, that when there were various times when pagan heretical or even just not heretical, but just sort of different, would get exiled by the empire, a lot of them would end up in places like Arabia. Arabia was and is, of course, it's mostly a desert, right? It's all the interior of it is a desert, and then the fringes all around are more fertile, and that's where all the cities are around the coastline. And the middle part of it is all very much the realm of the Bedouins, which are nomadic goat and sheep herders. There's a wonderful passage in T.E. Lawrence's book, Lawrence of Arabia, who wrote the Seven Pillars of Wisdom. His initial discussion of what shapes the character of Arabia has always been the desert. So people come in, they come in from the outside, they push out the inhabitants of the coastlands, they get pushed further into the desert, they become nomads, they spend a couple of decades, you know, and maybe their children grow up in the desert, and then they get fierce and strong, and then they come out of the desert and they push people back out, and then they land on the coastlands and the easier living, and they get soft, and then eventually someone comes and pushes them out. And so there is no Arabs, Muslims today, Arabs are kind of fond of saying they're the descendants of Ishmael. That's really not true. I mean, maybe some of them are, but it's actually quite cosmopolitan. A lot of people from a lot of different places have come and mixed and been part of the whole kind of culture of Arabia. That's very, very, it's very nomadic, very fluid, very shifting. A lot of different religious, there was a big Christian kingdom there. In the 7th century, they had built a dam and everything and dammed up this river that made this big floodplain, had a very prosperous, they were people that had come from Ethiopia, and then the Muslims came and destroyed them. But, so he lived in this area, so there was paganism, there was pagan worship, there was, There was Islam, or there was Judaism, there was Christianity, and there were lots of the variations on Christianity. And in 610 AD, so he would have been 40 years old, in a cave he had a vision. He says he had a vision. He had a vision from the angel Gabriel that came and gave him a vision of uniting all these different religions, kind of pulling them all together and making them one united faith. And he started preaching that. He's with the committed support of his wife, who was his first convert. He started preaching that in the city of Mecca. And in particular, what he appears to, his early preaching seems to be mostly a kind of a unity version of Christianity and Judaism with some pagan elements, but with all of the idolatry taken out. He was very, very passionately against idol worship. And so he didn't want any idolatry at all. And he said even like Christianity with all their icons and everything had been corrupted by idolatry. And so but the Bible, Jesus, Moses, all of them had all had parts of the truth, but now he'd had the whole thing. And the religious doctrine early on seemed to be pretty mild, actually. Seemed to be pretty, being kind, being honest. He was big on reining in the mistreatment of slaves and women and things like that. And passionately teach against idolatry. And the people of Mecca hated it. They hated it a lot. Because Mecca was the center of idol worship of the pagan religions, and it was the basis of their economy. So people would go on pilgrimage to Mecca, and they would worship, they had all these idols there, and they would come and spend money in the city and everything. It's like somebody going and preaching against gambling in Las Vegas, it might not go very far. That was like the center of their economy. So they ran him out. He had to flee for his life. He made some converts, but they all had to flee. They ran him out. They were going to kill him. And that was in 622 AD, an event which is known as the Hegira, the flight, which is a major event in the Muslim, the whole Muslim history. He fled instead to the city of Medina, which was the other biggest city in the area in Arabia, and started to preach there. And now, after the experience of the rejection of Mecca and the Hegira, his preaching started to become much more militant, much more intolerant, aggressive, and he started really building a following. At first, they started with raids against caravans coming in and out of Mecca, which in their mind was just compensation for all of the property that had been confiscated from Muhammad and his followers when they were forced out of Mecca. So they started with raids, but they quickly gained such a following that they were actually able to return and conquer Mecca, which they did in 632 AD, which you'll also notice is the year that Muhammad died. So he conquered Mecca, or he conquered Mecca. He'd already conquered Medina. With those two, the two largest cities in Arabia, he was fairly quickly able, and his followers, to bring the rest of Arabia under his control. So that by the end of 632, if you'll look at that map there, down in the back, the lined area is the area that he had controlled by the end of his life. Medina and Mecca and a big chunk of Arabia is now under his control in 632. So like I said, his early teaching was again, pretty mild, pretty sort of generic moralism and no idolatry, but there wasn't a great deal that was distinctive about it. to the point where a lot of scholars note the fact that the very earliest archaeological artifacts we have of Islam, like their earliest temples built and so forth, they don't face Mecca. They face Jerusalem. There are actually scholars that believe that Muhammad never existed and was a fabrication of the first caliph, or to create a religious mythology to justify his rule. Probably not that, but we do definitely know that Islam was very much in a, there was a period of redaction and editing where the Quran kind of took shape and from the earliest time that was a pretty mild generic moralism to, it's one of the problems with Islam is that as a Muslim reading the Quran, you can say Islam is a really tolerant, peaceful, it's not a militant religion at all. And that's true if you kind of select those parts of the Quran, like the earlier parts of his teaching and so forth. But then there's all the other stuff that, you know, kill the Jews, hunt them down, you know, all that kind of stuff. but what Islam becomes is a program for what Muhammad and his followers see as a just and well-ordered society. That's really what it's all about. It's not near, a lot of times when we focus on, well, you're supposed to get paradise if you die in battle, and, you know, some of those things are true, or they said those things, but they don't focus on the afterlife near like we do. Their goal really, what they're really intense about really is the creation of a just earthly society. The word itself, Islam, the word means submission. That is the meaning of the word. And the idea is that under Islam, everybody submits to Allah, of course, but then also then submits to their proper place within society. And everybody has a proper place. And it's a very, ideally, the purpose is this very well-ordered hierarchical where everybody knows who they're supposed to obey and what they're supposed to do, and it's your place within this larger society is very much what it's all about. Muhammad, in many ways, plays a very similar role to the Muslim faith, even though he was never claimed to be God or anything like that. He is believed to be sinless. And for that reason, Muhammad's life and behavior becomes a model for the Muslim, just as Jesus' life and behavior is. For us, Jesus is much more than just a model, of course, but he is that. He is, you know, that let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. And that's very much, so anything that Muhammad did in his life, by definition, must be a good thing, at least for him, because he's the benchmark. Now, Muhammad seems like a pretty decent guy for a 6th century warlord, you know, but that's their big problem. He was a 6th century warlord and did all the things that 6th and 7th century, like he wasn't a worse guy than, say, Pepin the Short, you know, for example. Pepin the Short massacred his enemies too, you know, but nobody looks at Pepin the Short to say he's a model for all Christians afterward. Jesus is a model we can very much live up to, right? Muhammad as a model, he enslaved people. He had an 11-year-old wife, you know, or 9-year-old or something. He was a 7th century warlord and did all the things that folks like that did. But it becomes a system, it becomes a vision for a just society, and then it becomes militantly aggressive in their desire to take that model of a just society out to the world. Now, Christianity does the exact same thing. Christianity also becomes aggressively militant in the sense of taking the gospel out to the world, right? Of course, there's one very major difference, and that was that the gospel was to spread by preaching and by persuasion. Not that it always did, but that was what we were supposed to do, right? And Islam was spread primarily by conquest, which is what then happened. In 632, Muhammad died, and the first caliphate began, which was known as the Rashidun Caliphate. Rashidun, the other caliphate, other caliphates, the Umayyad Caliphate and the Abbasid Caliphate, are dynasties. Those are names of family lines, like we think of normal dynasties, right? The Rashidun Caliphate was not that. The Rashidun Caliphate, Rashidun means rightly guided. These are kind of the four original caliphates. They were all close associates of Muhammad himself. They're always kind of seen as like the best, the benchmark. These were the good guys. And then it all kind of got corrupt and bad after that. It was not an inherited position. It was each time one died, the Muslim leaders as a whole would get together and they would select a new caliphate. After that, they were all dynasties. But the Rashidun Caliphate came out of the Arabian Peninsula. Their army, probably at that, initially their army was probably something like 30,000 soldiers, horsemen. And they came out at just exactly the right time, or the wrong time, depending on which side of the battle line you were on. They came out into the Levant and they attacked Palestine, attacked Syria, attacked the Persian Empire, and the Byzantine Empire, and had an absolutely tremendous level of success. Unbelievable. A much smaller, you know, a bunch of nomadic herdsmen from Arabia basically just went right out and attacked the two biggest empires in the world at the time and beat them both. Now, when you say it like that, it sounds crazy, but when you look at the details, the fact is that the Persians and the Byzantines had been at war with one another for centuries. And all of their military tactics were built around the militaries of their enemies. So they were very used to fighting large, pretty static, heavy infantry, heavy cavalry, armies composed largely of conscripts, armies composed largely of people who mostly didn't want to be there very much. And they had taxed their people heavily to pay for that. There was also a lot of religious persecution, both in Persia and in the Byzantine Empire, with the result that the area, and especially around the areas that they first attacked, were areas where a lot of the population, like a lot of the population in the Byzantine Empire where they attacked, these were Nestorians and Monophysites. Remember these groups that were marginalized, exiled, and persecuted by the Byzantine Empire for relatively minor disagreements of theology, right? With the result that they didn't really have a lot of loyalty to the Byzantine Empire. The taxes were heavy. The Muslims promised them a much greater level of tolerance than they received under the Byzantine Empire, and they followed through. They were actually most of those people, and certainly Christians in the Persian Empire, were much better off under the Muslims than they were under the Persians. Sadly, a lot of Christians under the Byzantine Empire were much better off under the Muslims than they were under the Byzantines as well. With the result that fairly quickly, within a few decades, the Muslims had entirely conquered the Persian Empire. Took the whole thing. Again, this is one of the oldest, most powerful empires on the earth. And they just folded. they just didn't know what to do with these rapidly moving, highly skilled, very fierce. Static empires have always struggled to know what to do with horse archers. To be a good horse archer, to shoot effectively from horseback, you have to basically train from childhood. It's like all you do. It's like that's, and it's like the American Indians, like the Comanches and the Apaches that we had such a hard, I mean, the Comanches single-handedly stopped the northern progress of the Spanish Empire. The Spanish didn't know what to do with them. They couldn't deal with them. You know, you got even guys with rifles. You got a rifle, you know, you can shoot that guy and then, you know, put it down and back and load it up again, get it back up, boom. And you'd have to be a really good horseman to effectively shoot that rifle from horseback. So the fact that most of them, they would ride their horses into battle and then they would dismount and then they would fight on foot. Which meant that an effective Comanche warrior could fire 10 arrows in the time that you could fire one bullet. And they could do it from horseback while riding around you in a circle. Well, the Arab warriors were like that too. They were nomads. They learned war from their youth. They learned it in the harsh conditions of the desert. So these guys could make long forced rides through arid areas. They could be in places where they were not, they were just showing up all of a sudden way further along than they were supposed to be. They could move a lot faster than the Persian armies, which again were very static and very built on heavy formations and heavy infantry and large supply trains. And that's why a relatively small force of nomadic horse archers, were able to destroy this whole empire, conquer it within like 20 years. It was an amazing, amazing feat. They didn't defeat the Byzantines for another 1,000 years almost, but they pushed them way back. They weren't able to conquer the whole empire, but they did push them way back. The Byzantines lost a lot of territory. Under first the Rashidun Caliphate, and then under the second Caliphate, the Umayyad Caliphate. After the first four, then there was a civil war. So they spent about 25 years really strongly advancing, and then they had about 5 years of a lot of internal conflict. They had a civil war. It was one of the problems the Muslims have always faced, and they face it right down to our own day, is when the goal is the creation of a just society, the creation of the just and perfect society. Well, first of all, that's a goal you're never going to reach, right? It always fails because this world is cursed and fallen. And the problem is then everybody's always got an idea about why it's failed, and it's always the other guy's fault. The reason is, of course, is that the ones that are in charge are corrupt and wicked, and if we were in charge and we're good and righteous, and then we would achieve the dream of the caliphate. I mean, you see that phenomena right down in our own day with the rise of ISIS, and it was the same kind of thing. The ISIS were more passionately devoted to the original cause of Islam, whereas all these other kingdoms and states were corrupted by the Westerners and the Jews, and that's why they were so evil and wicked, and they had the pure vision, you know. Islam always has suffered from that problem. So they had 25 years or so of tremendous expansion, and then they had 5 years of civil war. And then after that, the winners of the civil war erected what was known as the Umayyad Caliphate, which was a more traditional kind of hereditary caliphate. A caliphate, by the way, the caliph, classical Islam doesn't have any sense of the separation of church and state. Such a concept doesn't even, it's not even that they think that's wrong, it's just that it doesn't even make any sense to them. The state is religious to them. Inescapably religious. Secular society, the idea of a state in which different religions have different, is something that the traditional, actually most of the world, I mean, it took Christianity to promote that idea. The caliph is a religious figure and a political figure. He is the leader of, it was sort of like in the old Roman Empire, it was the same thing, right? The emperor was the head of the state, but he was also the head of the Roman religion, because those two things were so closely intertwined. They were inseparable, really. And it was very much that is true in Islam as well. And so the Umayyad Caliphate, now the Umayyad Caliphate really concentrates, they reached a stalemate with Byzantium. Byzantium learned how to fight them and held the line for a long, long time. The Caliphate, if you look back on your map again, you can see the darker blue there is the expansion under the first caliphs. It doesn't break out the distinction there between the but the line up to you see right above Iraq, kind of the line stops there, and there's a big Byzantine Empire there, so it stops just right into Asia Minor, or what's now Turkey, right to the north of Iraq and Syria there. It spreads east to Persia. They did push that line, under the Umayyads. Yeah, there is that lighter color there. Then the Umayyads push that east a fair bit. And they also push west. North Africa has started to come under under the first caliphs. I think that maybe shouldn't be quite so far into North Africa. But under the Umayyads, they did go the rest of the way into North Africa, up into Spain, and even into the Frankish kingdom. And the Umayyads lasted until, I don't have a date on there for the Umayyad Caliphate, about 750 or so. So that first century, you see that first century, it was really amazing. And a lot of times, you know, you take, as an example, you take Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great has a reputation for being one of the greatest conquerors the world has ever seen. And he was a great conqueror, he's a great strategist and all of that. But a big part of the reason why Alexander was as successful as he was because of the extremely high quality military that his father, Philip II of Macedonia, had built. He had these just really highly trained soldiers, these really excellent soldiers. And that was a big part of the reason why Alexander was able to be as successful as he was. So lots of times we look at just this one figure. Was it Khalid ibn Walid, you know, their first great general? Well, he was an amazing general. But he also had amazing troops. I mean, these guys were, he was famous for the famous line that he sent a message to the Persians, telling them he was coming and saying, "You should know that I have an army composed of young men who love death as you love life." You know, and that was, you know, the idea. These men will happily fight to the death. And they are used to living in the harshest conditions. You know, they grew up in the desert of Arabia. You know, these were hard, hard men. And extremely skilled on horseback. And that generation and the next, they have this century of just unbroken conquest. Until, you'll remember perhaps the date 732 sticks out. If you remember, one century after the death of Muhammad, they had conquered the Persians, they'd conquered most of the old Roman Empire, they'd pushed up into Byzantium, conquered Spain, at the Straits of Gibraltar, conquered Spain, except for one little strip along the north, and pushed up all the way into the Frankish Empire, where they were stopped by a man dramatically named Charles the Hammer at the Battle of Tours in 732 AD. We talked about that before. So you look at that map, and you see all that colored area. Just that all happened within one century, 100 years. And the world was changed forever, you know. When did the Roman Empire really fall? Probably as a result of the Muslims. We often say 476. That was the end of the political entity known as the Roman state, the Roman Empire. True. But as we said before, the old Roman order really continued. All the conquerors, they all just copied Roman ways. They copied the Roman religion, they copied the Roman law, they tried to keep up the aqueducts and the baths and everything as best they could, you know. They didn't want to destroy Rome, they wanted to be Rome. They took Roman names. They all spoke Latin pretty quick, you know, gave up their old languages, a lot of them. The Goths and the Vandals especially, and became Roman. The whole Roman Empire, the whole Roman system, since the days of Caesar, since Caesar destroyed the pirates, was built on trade around the Mediterranean. And the Muslims ended that. That was one of the major, major effects of the Muslim assault, was the end of the Mediterranean trade. The Mediterranean became unsafe. You couldn't trade in Mediterranean because it was likely that if you did, you would get attacked by Muslim raiders, and all of you be sold into slavery. Slave raids across southern Europe, Italy, southern France happened for centuries and centuries after that. The battle hymn of the Marines, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. You know where that comes from? It was fighting Muslim pirates that came out of the kingdom of Tripoli in the 1700s. They were still kidnapping American soldiers. I mean, kidnapping among many others. They were also kidnapping. I mean, trade in the Mediterranean was still very difficult as late as the 1700s. Because of the Muslims. What we think of the Dark Ages, which if there was any period of time which would properly be called the Dark Ages, is probably something like 600 to 1000 AD or so, right in there. And the Dark Ages were primarily the Dark Ages because Europe had been entirely cut off from foreign trade. You know, the age of explorers and everybody, like what was Christopher Columbus really trying to accomplish? All those guys, Magellan and everybody, what they were really trying to accomplish was opening up good trade routes that weren't dependent, couldn't be blocked by the Muslims. Again, if you look at the map, now see, the Muslims didn't have that problem. Why didn't the Muslims have that problem? Well, they couldn't trade very effectively along the Mediterranean either for the same reason. But look where the Islamic Empire goes. It goes all the way over to Persia. And from there, it's an easy straight shot east to India, to China, south to Africa. They've got all that open to them. Europe didn't have any of that. Europe, if you know, they've got what's north of Europe, what's west of Europe, as far as they know at that time, nothing. Endless oceans that they didn't know how to cross. Or icy tundra. If you go east, well, you're going to go into Siberia, but you're not going to get anywhere particularly rich and profitable without crossing Muslim lands. And that's why it was so difficult. That's why trade became such a big deal. That's what Columbus was all about. Columbus was about trade routes because they needed effective foreign trade to compete with the Muslims. It really was all of that area that they took. All of that was most of that. The Persian Empire wasn't Christian. The Persian Empire was Zoroastrian. The rest of that was Christian territory that they took away from Christianity. It was a devastating blow. A very, very difficult time for Christians in Europe. A major contraction, impoverishment, loss of tremendous amounts of literature and knowledge and learning, and they lost access to all of that stuff. Was in the East, Greek philosophy and all that. Yeah, just so much of it was in Syria and in Persia and in Egypt. They just lost access to all of that. Huge amounts of commerce and trade and learning and all sorts of things that were lost effectively to the Christian world as a result of the very, very rapid, especially back then, things just didn't move that fast. So for 100 years, just in one century, The whole world changed. And they just couldn't adapt fast enough. And the result was a tremendous contraction of population in Europe. Increased probability of famines and things. Because trade is one really great way of balancing out famines, right? If your own crops fail, well, then you buy food from other places, right? But if you don't have access to foreign trade, you can't do that. Islam is very positive about slavery. They view slavery as a good thing, always have, still do. They promoted it. Muhammad himself had many slaves. And one of the features of one of the effects that this expansion had on it was that it gave Muslim kingdoms easy access for slave raids all up into Europe, which they engaged in for centuries and centuries. There were millions of white European Christians taken slaves into... the word slave comes from the word Slav. The Slavs in, which are the Slavic people, Russia, Ukraine, Bulgaria, Romania, all those are kind of collectively known as the Slavs. And they were especially hard hit by the slave trade and the Muslims for centuries. Vlad the Impaler, you know, some of these characters like Vlad the Impaler, for example, he got his reputation fighting Muslim invaders, you know, and went to extreme tactics to repel them, which is why he got the brutal reputation that he had. So the war in Ukraine right now, for example, the war in Ukraine, which is a lot of it's over Crimea, for example. You know, you can't really understand that war unless, like, why does Russia want Crimea back? Well, because Crimea has always been Russian since the 1700s. And it became Russian. There was a Khanate, a kingdom of Muslims called the Crimean Khanate, which for about 500 years was the base of slave raids up into Russia and Poland and Eastern Europe, which took millions of suppressed growth. There was no place safe in Russia from Muslim slave raiders for centuries. Until under Catherine the Great, they finally conquered them, took it, and made it Russian territory. And then under the Soviets, under Stalin, Crimea was transferred to the Ukraine just as sort of a bookkeeping thing, because it was all one empire at that time. And then after the Soviet Union fell apart, well, Ukraine just decided to keep it, even though it had always been part of Russia. And all the people there speak Russian and are ethnic Russians and want to be in Russia and they don't want to be in Ukraine. So, you know, one way how the history of these things can give us perspective on current events. But we were talking about the factors contributing to Islam's success. Any questions or comments so far before we look at a little bit more of this? I've been rattling on for some time. Islam's great success, a lot of it was because of the weakness of the Persian and the Byzantine Empire, as we said before. Both of those were old, creaky, sclerotic, bureaucratic, and pretty oppressive, which is why they just really could not adapt or had a very hard... The Byzantines did better than the Persians, but both of them had a real difficulty adapting to this new... very young, very vibrant, very energetic threat that they just didn't know how to deal with. Oppression of Persian and Byzantine. They were both religiously intolerant. They were both high taxes to support this constant warfare going on between the two of them. We talked about the military tactics. Let's talk about their occupation policy some. Like, how did they treat their conquered peoples? Because remember, all of these areas, so we think of like Libya and Tunisia and Egypt and so forth, Syria, all of these areas of being very heavily Muslim areas, which they are, but they were Christian. They were entirely Christian nations. How did that change? The Muslim occupation policies were really quite clever. Really quite effective. They didn't tell anybody they had to convert, except for pagans. Pagan idol worshippers did. Pagan idol worshippers, the choice was convert or die. Because of Muhammad's attitude towards idol worship, that was so corrupt that you couldn't do that. But if you were monotheists, and particularly if you're a people of the book, as they called them, but really it extended to Zoroastrians as well. Zoroastrianism was the most common religion in Persia, which is a monotheistic religion. Then you had three choices. You could convert, or you could accept the status of a dhimmi, D-H-I-M-M-I, which is basically a second-class citizen, or you can die, you know. So you had more choices. So a lot of people in those Christians and Jews and Zoroastrians became what was known as a dhimmi, a second-class citizen. Dhimmis were usually, the dhimmi had to pay what was known as the jizya, which was a religious tax. How big that tax was, at times it was just a token. It really wasn't a big deal. Other times it was pretty oppressive. The approach towards the dhimmi depended a great deal on the location and on the particular rulers involved. But it always involved a few things like, for example, you usually wouldn't be allowed to hold political office. You usually couldn't try and convert other people to your faith. Or at least you couldn't try to convert Muslims to your faith. Sometimes if it was other people than Muslims, they didn't care. But you couldn't convert Muslims to your faith. Sometimes you weren't allowed to build any new church buildings. Or even, if they were more restrictive, even be able to renovate old ones. They wouldn't want any visible sign of other religions. They wanted visibly other religions were kind of forced into a second class status. They were suppressed. They were, kind of very visibly and dramatically be shown to be lesser. And sometimes dhimmis had to wear special clothes or special, badges or things that would show that they were not Muslims. And the result of that, in some places where Christianity, like for example in Egypt and Syria, where Christianity had been a long, long time there, in Iraq, where Christianity had been a long, long time, those communities persisted nonetheless. There are Coptic Christians in Egypt even today. Nestorian Christians in what was Assyria, in Syria and in Iraq. Although, sadly, the foolish policies of our own government have resulted in the destruction of most of those. But those communities lasted a long, long time. But in a lot of places, in North Africa in particular, where Christianity was never as strong, and especially where the Arians had come in, they had suppressed Orthodox Christianity, had really, really weakened Orthodox Christianity by the Vandals, you know, their rule of North Africa for that time. They really weakened Orthodox Christianity, and they hadn't really succeeded in, you know, Arian Christianity just never really lasted very long. And so they were fairly easy prey. And in those places, over time, most all of them converted. And often pretty quickly. That there was just too much pressure to be a Muslim. If they had taken a more intolerant approach where, man, you just, you know, convert or die, those populations probably would have fought them a lot harder. And instead, actually in a lot of cases, dhimmi status was better than the oppressive policies of their previous rulers. So as a result, like I said, the result of that was over time, varying by place to place, but they solidified that religious, not only the political control, because obviously early on it was just a very small minority of people in Egypt or in Libya, North Africa, Syria, very small minority of them that were Muslim. But over time, most of those countries, most of those people converted as the generations went on. There was too much disadvantage to being of another religion, and they bowed to the pressure. That's why all those areas are Muslim now. I think I don't want to get into this next section until next week. So we focus here on, like I said, we focus on five, you know, that first century. After that, the expansion slowed down to some degree for a couple of hundred years until the Ottomans, the Turks, come, and then things change again. The dynasty after the Umayyads were known as the Abbasids. They were centered in Persia. They started really focusing on making Islam a more universal religion, not so focused on the Arabs. They reckoned, we conquered all these people. We need to make them all equal partners in this. They moved the capital to Persia. They were very heavily influenced by Persian nobility and so forth. This is the period probably from 750 to about 1000 AD or so, which is usually spoken of as the golden age of Islam. This is the time when Islam has tremendous scientific advances and cultural achievements. It built beautiful buildings and cities and accomplished a great deal. Interestingly, it was probably Nestorian Christians, because they conquered the area that was like in Syria and in Iraq, where there were a lot of Nestorian Christians under there. And the Christians, having been oppressed pretty heavily, both by the Byzantines and also by the Persians, they actually liked the Muslim rulers quite well and worked closely with them. And it was probably those Eastern Christians that taught the Muslims Greek, taught them and helped them translate Aristotle and Plato and all the older works of science and culture into Arabic, which led to the great flowering of Arabic knowledge through this period. A lot of times people will say, and you know, there's some truth to it. It's like in 1000 AD, the Arabs were way more scientifically advanced than Western Europe was, and that's undoubtedly true. But the irony is, it was probably Nestorian Christians that gave them that knowledge in the first place. So the Abbasids, they didn't do a lot of conquering. They were more, and actually fairly quickly, their caliphate started to kind of fall apart, and that led to the rise of lots of smaller, there were lots of attempts to start a new caliphate, but they were always kind of local. There was a caliphate in Egypt, and there was a caliphate in North Africa, and there was another one in Spain, and so forth. And none of them really ever became true caliphates, because they didn't represent all of Islam, which is what a caliphate is supposed to do. It's supposed to be just one caliphate that governs the whole Islamic world. After the Umayyads and the first couple of centuries, the first century or so of the Abbasids, that was never true again, that one caliphate would truly represent all of them. The rise, I don't know if you remember back when ISIS was kind of a big deal in the news, that was very much what ISIS was trying to do. ISIS was, they were establishing a new caliphate, and it was going to be the final caliphate that was going to usher in the coming of their Mahdi, their Messiah, and didn't happen at all, but any questions about any of that or discussion? Like I said, I want to talk about the effect, the broader effect that it had on Christianity next time. Because it did set up profound changes within Christianity, both West and East. So yeah, Zach.
Not seeing distinction between church and state, really.
Right.
Does that make it really difficult for them to live in a pluralistic society then?
Well, it's funny.
Yeah.
It does. But it's funny. You know, I was, there's a book, Dominion by Tom Holland. Not that Tom Holland, the other one. Not Spider-Man. where he talks about the impact that Christianity has, the tremendous, tremendous impact that Christianity's had on the world. It's a fascinating book. But one of the things he says is that when a Muslim moves to America and says, I am a good American citizen and I am a Muslim, he is being a Muslim in a very Christian way. he is actually deeply impacted in his view of Islam by Christianity. Because it's a Christian perspective that says, here is my religion, but I can separate that from my politics. And maybe I don't want my politics to try and advance my view of religion. My politics are going to be affected by my religion, of course. And all of ours are, our view of. But I don't think it's the job of the U.S. government to spread the Christian faith. I want the U.S. government to protect the Christian faith, to countenance the spread of the gospel, but I don't think it's their job to spread the gospel. I don't want them to spread the gospel. They'll do a bad job of it, right? That is a uniquely Christian perspective. No other religion in the world thinks like that, or didn't 2,000 years ago. Now they all think that way. You know, a Hindu comes here. Because Hinduism, again, if you went back 2,000 years ago and said, okay, you're an Indian, you live in India, but what is your religion? That would have been a nonsense question to them. They wouldn't have known what the heck you were talking about. So I'm in India, I worship Indian gods. Doesn't everybody do that? You live in, what is the religion of the Norse in 0 AD? You know, I live in Norway, I worship Norwegian gods. That's what you did. The idea that you would choose your religion and that would somehow be different than your nationality, your ethnicity, those things were all just a piece. You know, which again was why Christianity was very difficult for even Rome to accept, you know, was that idea. That starting first with the Jews and the Jewish diaspora, where somebody would be a Jew in someone else's country, and they could still be a Jew and a loyal citizen. And then that grew into Christianity even more so. So, a Muslim, and this is a tremendous tension within the Muslim community even now, I know, is the Muslim, because the Muslim has to say, can I really be true to the heart of Islam and a good American citizen at the same time? And different Muslims, you know, the earlier Muslim immigrants seem to thread that needle different than the later. You know, the later wave seem to be more, you know, especially as numbers grow, then you see the old attitudes reasserting themselves in lots of cases. You know, when there's a smaller, fewer number of what you might think of more as secular Muslims, it doesn't seem to be as much of a problem. They seem to be able to, you know, go to their mosque and have their Friday service and do their things, but not see that as in conflict with being a loyal American citizen. But as the numbers of Muslims grow, that generally tends to become a problem. Because fundamental to Islam, I mean, Islam is fundamentally, again, it's about, what it's about is about a particular kind of social order. And it's about a social order that is fundamentally at odds with Western civilization that grew out of Christianity. Which is something I think Western cultures really, really need to think carefully about when we're contemplating bringing over a large number of Muslim immigrants. Which we tend to not do. Or if we are thinking heavily about it, then we're thinking about it in the wrong way. So, and that's causing increasing tension all through Western Europe, especially. We don't have, certain locations have large number of Muslims, and that's creating problems. You know, I know like in Michigan and different places, but America as a whole doesn't have the large number of Muslim immigrants that like Germany does, or France, or, you know, where it's really, those tensions are becoming really unmanageable in a lot of places. But,
well, it's like every other religion, they really can't practice their religion in the U.S. because of our laws. Like, you know, a Hindu can't, like, practice the caste system.
Yeah, or, yeah, exactly.
Or they can't have four wives.
Right.
We're not going to do that.
So. Yeah, that's absolutely right. That a lot of those religions require, to truly observe them, they require a whole political order which is built around those religions. Yeah, exactly. The caste system is a great example. The caste system is not an accidental feature of Hindu life. The caste system is part of their faith.
They have to have it, otherwise they're whole.
Yeah, it's like they're very religious. The whole system of karma and everything is all built on the caste system. And the British went in and made it illegal. So, yeah.
It makes sense to do it that way.
Yeah, yeah. I
just cooked out that. Like, it didn't really work.
Well, I mean, it was, you know, I think of that great example of the general that's coming across the group of Hindus that are about to practice sati. Do you know what sati is? That was when a man died, they would automatically burn his wife on his funeral pyre, burn her to death. So that she could join him in the afterlife, right? Guy's got to have a wife in the afterlife too. So, and so they would, the wife would be thrown onto the funeral pyre of the husband. That was a traditional practice called sati. And so a British general comes along and he says, no, you can't do that anymore. We're, you know, that's, and they said, well, it's our tradition. And so he says, okay, well, you practice your tradition of sati, and then I will practice my tradition of hanging people who kill women. So we'll all practice our tradition, and we'll all be happy. So they didn't do it. No. Yeah, it's it kind of raises big questions about the whole idea of secularism and pluralism. You know, can you really, I think, ironically, a Christian political system is the only one that really can tolerate other faiths. Because we're not seeking the creation of a particular earthly paradise.
I mean, we can't tolerate other religions in their whole.
We can tolerate them as long as they are willing to live in a legal system that is based on Christianity, I think. And it's kind of up to them to decide how much they're able to. But the problem is that ultimately becomes self-undermining when you have more and more. They're inevitably going to want to alter the religious system to fit that. Like having four wives, for example, which is seen as it's not only something that's okay in Islam, it's seen as the right and proper order of things, you know, because polygamy inherently creates a hierarchical system with men very much on top and women subjugated, which is how they view that it needs to be. And so that's their legal system is built around that. And Christianity is not, you know, so just kind of hand waving about, oh, well, we can all just have our own religions and. Not always that simple. Political systems are ultimately always going to be based on religious principles. Can't be otherwise. Has to be. But like I said, my own conviction is that because Christianity is not seeking the establishment, or shouldn't be seeking the establishment of the ideal earthly state, then we can actually practice toleration of other faiths and not need to suppress them as long as they are willing to live within our political order. But other political order, other religious political orders that grow out of different religious orders really struggle with that, I think. Which is why, you know, again, even now, I mean, you know, we prayed a couple weeks ago for Indian Christians because, and we don't think of it this, but India is actually the top 10 countries for religious persecution right now. It is really difficult to be a Christian in India all of a sudden. And it's because of the rise of Hindu nationalism. More and more they are trying to reassert the old model where the nation and the religion go together. And so foreign religions destroy national unity and hamper the ability of the legal system to support the religious perspective of the nation. And so they're trying to forcibly get Christians to convert or leave or die. And it's really tough. Other questions or comments? Okay, well, let's go ahead and close in prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for your blessings. Thank you for your kingdom and your truth. And Lord, we even thank you for these challenges that have arisen over the centuries. We know you do good in all that you do. We know that the rise of Islam was and still is a great challenge to the Christian faith. But seen properly, we know that you have done your work through it and have sharpened and perfected your people through that challenge. And we pray that you would help us to continue to be strong and humble and yet firm in our insistence on your truth and your kingdom and the principles of your word as we interact and deal with other religions. Lord, we pray all these things in Jesus' precious name. Amen.